Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 22, delivered on April 15th.
Moving along now, tonight, component costs of capital. This has to do with the pieces of the overall weighted average cost of capital. There's equity and there's debt, and there's different kinds of equity and actually different kinds of debt too. So we will go through the little formulas to get those different pieces. It's not really difficult. It's just sort of like arithmetic. There's some algebra that motivates it, nothing hard there. But then it's just down to arithmetic to get the actual pieces. Before we do that, however, we'll have a brief look at the market today. And of course, as usual, I have not got the screen set up for that. Just irritates me to no end that I always do that. Okay, now let's try that again. Have a look at the markets here. I said have a look at the markets here and see what happened today. It was a bad day, on the market. And I can speak to that personally because I don't just teach finance, I do it in the investments world. This was a really heart-stopping kind of day. To give you an idea of how volatile this was, and this has a lot to do with the riskiness of my portfolio, my slush portfolio. At one point, at the market open, I was down $800. 3 hours later, I was up $50. And then by the end of the day, I was down $300. So it was an emotional roller coaster, and it goes to the old piece of advice, don't watch what you don't want to see. Just close your eyes and just wait. But no, I had to keep looking at the stupid thing all day. As you can see, the market was getting paddled today. There wasn't really a pattern. The S&P 500 took the brunt of the whipping today. The Dow was down, but not as much as the S&P, and the NASDAQ wasn't down as much as either of the big broad indices. Now, this Russell 2000, I kind of ignore it. It is small cap stocks, very small cap, and it's an index, and if I'm not mistaken, it's not even a weighted index. They just add up the prices and divide by the number of stocks, and they get your average, and that just took a beating today. Now, one thing, caution about the NASDAQ, is that, yes, it is small cap companies. However, there are some huge companies in there. And if the whole market is, if all small caps, most small caps, I should say, are going downward, but those two big ones, or three or four or five big, huge ones, are having a good day, they can kind of make it look like the overall, they can make the overall index look not that bad. And it might have been the case here with the NASDAQ today. I would have to look at some of those huge companies that are in the NASDAQ. Did they go up today? And was that why the NASDAQ doesn't look as bad as it should? One way or the other, though, moving over and looking at, okay, so clearly money was pulling out of equities, in other words, stocks. And so the question would be, well, where was that money going? And if we go over here, well, in first place, in a flight to quality, that money would go into bonds because they're safer. And they don't give as much return, but at least they're not as volatile and all that. So we look over here and we see the 10-year bond took a bath too. So in other words, money was being pulled out of equities. Equities were being sold. Stock was being sold. It was also pulling out of at least some bonds. Bonds were being sold. So the money was going out of both of those. Where did it land? Well, the next place I would look is gold. Yeah, gold went up, but that wasn't really a significant push upward. That's only 0.39%. So yeah, maybe some money did go into gold, but the money didn't really, the bulk of what was coming out was the money was pulling out of all of these things. So where in the world was it going? Well, that would probably indicate to me that it was going into something super safe, essentially what we call cash. Now, that doesn't mean they were just cashing in and putting the money under their mattress. When I say cash, usually that means it was going into money markets. very safe, almost no return. It's just sitting there. Those money markets might invest in short-term T-bills, whatever, or just sort of languish there, living the best life possible, working for doing no work whatsoever. So my suspicion would be, and I'd have to confirm this, that money was pulling out of most of the markets and it was just going straight into the safest thing it could, cash and cash equivalents. It's not a good sign. Kind of concerning, as a matter of fact. And if you will look here, this was a, and again, I emphasize this every time, do not do what I do as far as investment. But you can see I was taking a beating today. I might as well have the market autograph the boot mark they put on my butt today. It was a grim day. The only highlights were this stock right here, which is a one of the biotechs that is in the race for a vaccine for the Corona SARS-2, what we commonly call the COVID-19 virus. And it was improving very strongly today. It scared the hell out of me. This one, USO, I am betting against oil by betting against this stock, which is United States Oil or something, US Oil or something like that. So that one was good, but everything else just slapped the hell out of me today. And so this is the heart attack region that you don't want to be in unless you got the emotional fortitude to do it, and you have this sort of, well, if it wins, it wins, if it doesn't, it doesn't. But you still have to keep your eye on it. If things go sour too fast on you, you need to get out of these, and that's why you have to watch the markets all day if you're an active trader, as I am. I'm not a day trader, for God's sake, but at the same time, I see these, and I'm saying, okay, if the pre-market doesn't look good on these tomorrow morning, in other words, there's a market before there's a market. There's buying and selling action going on before the official opening. The same is true after a market closes. There's a post-market, an aftermarket, where there's buying and selling activity. You want to keep an eye on the pre and the post. Tomorrow morning, I will be looking at the pre-market starting at about 7 o'clock in the morning, 7:30 Central Standard Time, just to see if this is still sour. If it's sour, I'll put in orders to get out of these things and take my beating as soon as the market opens. But if I have a hint that there was an overreaction and the prices are going to recover, then I sit for another day waiting for the excitement. Anyway, that's what this is all about, having a look at these different markets and seeing what's going on, working on them, playing this. But like I said, this is no amateur place at all, especially in what I do here in these markets. But if you are interested in this world, if this world kind of, there is someone giggling. If there is something, that might be my cat. Or it may be, I've got a guest here today, wanted to say a few words, but I might not let him say anything because he usually gets out of hand. And in quarantine with someone like this, it's just gotten to me. But anyway, stepping aside from this nonsense right here, going back to the happy time that we have left and talking about the component costs of capital. And again, this is just pretty much arithmetic. You don't even use Excel for these. They're formulas, so you just push them into your calculator and then you move on with your life. But to start off, just remember that the two broad types of capital are debt and equity. In other words, a company can borrow long-term funds to finance projects, or it can use stock to fund projects. Now, a couple of things about the debt. I'm going to be pretty darn generic about this, but as I had mentioned in the last lecture, this can get to be a lot like work, simply because there is not one debt. A company will issue, say, some bonds 1 year, 5 years later, they're going to issue some notes, and after that, there's just going to be this compilation of different debt, different times they went to the bank, well, went to the investment bankers, and issued bonds, that is, they borrowed money from investors. So there could be a lot of different grades and types of debt in a single company. That makes calculating the cost of debt a little bit trickier. Usually we look at, you can do it in Excel pretty quickly, but you're going to have on the books of a corporation, making it really simple. Suppose that 8 years ago, the company borrowed $100 million. on a coupon of, let's say, 6%. Okay, my first pass is to say that the cost of debt is going to be 6%. That's what it pays in interest. It pays that 6% on the $100 million every year for the life of the bond, and then at the end, it makes one last 6% of face value payment, and then it pays back the $100 million. So the first pass is that the cost of debt is just that coupon, RD. And I'm writing it that way because it isn't. The first thing we have to recognize is that the company gets to deduct the interest expense. So the actual cost of the debt is the original cost, the 6% coupon, times 1 minus the company's tax rate. Because there's a tax shield. The R sub D times T is a tax shield. It doesn't, in other words, I deduct that debt, that interest expense. And that means that I don't have that money at the pre-tax level hit with taxes. Unlike dividends, if I pay a dividend to my shareholders, that's after I've paid the corporation's taxes. So dividends are actually pretty, really expensive just compared to debt that way, because I get to deduct interest expense before I calculate the taxes the company owes. But the dividend, I don't get to deduct that until after the company has paid its taxes. Now, there's an interesting sidelight here, and I'll just mention this for just a second. Company, you see, there's a kind of a logical thing. Why would a company pay dividends? I mean, you know, in a way, it's the dividend that money is taxed at the corporate level. And then when your shareholders get it, they pay tax on it. That seems like an awfully silly thing. Why don't you just have 100% retention rate? In other words, all of the earnings of the company, you just plow back into the company and grow the company and thereby hopefully grow the stock price. What would motivate a company to pay a dividend if that's going to be what happens? There are arguments, there are different theories of why it happens, but the question still remains that debts, equity capital in all kinds of ways is more expensive than debt capital for the most part. Okay, anyway, getting back to it, there is the after-tax cost of debt. Unfortunately, if I've got on my books $50 million in debt, that's a historical exposure, a liability that's historical. At some time in the past, I committed myself as a corporation to paying $100 million. And I committed to paying an interest rate of 6%. So that 6%, or 6% times 1 minus tax rate, whatever you want to say, is a historical cost. We really would be more interested in the market's current cost of debt for that company. So we really need to do an adjustment. And that can be a real pain in the butt if you've got all these different kinds of debt and you have to do the cost of debt adjustment to each one individually. Normally, in the problems you'll get in your homework, they'll just be one kind of debt, make the adjustment if they ask you to. Now, how do we make the adjustment to the market instead of the book? The book would be $100 million at 6%. The market might say differently because those bonds are going to fluctuate in price. You saw it when we did that calculation. Bonds, if the yield is below the coupon, the bond sells at a premium to par. If the yield is above the coupon, then the bond sells at a discount to par. Well, we have to apply that. We have to look at, okay, this $100 million in debt, it was $100 million when it first hit the books, and that was probably what it was when it first hit the market. But now investors have been buying and selling that debt, adjusting for their current expectations of what the coupon should have been. And so we might see this bond that was originally at exactly par, $100 on the 100, or 1,000 on the 1,000, however you want to put it. Now, let's say that it's selling at 103 on the 100. So in other words, we would have to do an adjustment factor. In other words, I would have to say, well, for one thing, the current amount of debt is no longer 100 million. It's 100 million times that 1.03. In other words, 103 on the 100 or 1,030 on the 1,000. We would have to tweak it to make it truly a market debt. In other words, suppose this company wanted to clear that debt off its books right now. We're sick of having that debt on our books. Let's go out and pay it off. Well, if they paid it off, they wouldn't pay 100 million, they'd pay 103 million because that would be what the market would be expecting right now. It takes a while to soak in. But just like the stock, which I'll talk about in a minute, the bonds have a book value, but they also have a market value. What if the company wanted to pay off its debt right now? It would not pay off 100 million. It would pay off whatever the bond price is right now times the amount of the bonds. So if this bond, so if these bonds were selling at 100, let's say they were selling at 98 on the 100. Well, then I would take that 100 million and I'd say, well, 100 million times 0.98. Because if we go out to get rid of that debt right now, we wouldn't pay 100 million, we'd pay 9.8 million, 98 million. So you just do an adjustment factor to get the market value of the debt. Similarly, you are, and also you should probably not use the coupon rate 6% here. You should be using the yield to maturity on the debt because that's what the market says. The next time the company wants to borrow money, it's not going to be that coupon. It's going to be the yield to maturity because that's what the market said it should be paying right now. If you're following with me on this, then you're doing pretty well. I encourage you seriously. Is the audio dead right now?
Yes.
How's the audio sounding right now?
Trash.
Horrible.
Trash? No bueno.
Not good.
Is it bad now again? This has got to be Zoom. This has got to be Zoom. Because, I mean, it was fine there a while ago, and now it just sucks. Is that what's going on? Super choppy. Wow. This is really, really concerning me. I've got audio, but can you hear me now?
It's not really a matter of hearing. It's just like disconnecting.
Zoom can't. Okay. Someone says Zoom can't handle my content. You can't handle the truth, Zoom. Maybe someone's trying to hack in here again or something like that.
No, it's really staticky. Like every time you talk consistently, it's like.
Let me try this. Can you still hear me when I talk like this? Is the static still there? Does it sound better? Someone's saying yes. Yeah. Gain. The mic has kicked into a high gain, and so it's focusing on my voice. And when I, and it keeps adjusting. If I bring up my volume, it's trying to adjust to the gain on it. Excuse me. Anyway, let's try it this way. I'm going to try to keep my voice on a really level platform. Here, I wish they had a mixer control board so I could watch to see what I'm spiking on that, but there you go. I keep having video pictures of you popping up. Some of them are pretty good. Some of them are downright scary. Someone last time kept popping up with a red long mop wig on. That was really troubling, but anyway. Let's try, let's go at that again here. Now, by the way, interestingly enough, the audio is sometimes not so bad in the recorded version. And in YouTube, sometimes I don't catch what you're hearing in the live telecast. Modern technology and all of that. I do wish we'd use Cisco instead of Zoom for a couple of reasons. Security is one of them, but Cisco is so much more, it's been around so much longer, so much more sophisticated in its systems. But there you go. Can't have everything you want. Okay, let's go on with this just for a while longer. Keep talking in my normal voice, and if I start spiking, someone just let me know that I'm spiking again. Anyway, when I go into this R sub D, let me repeat this just to make sure that you're comfortable with it. We are concerned about market values, market costs, what the market says, not what the book says. The book says that the debt is 6% coupon debt on $100 million. The market says, well, that was true when the debt was issued, when the company borrowed it. It borrowed $100 million. However, at this time, the market says, well, you know, that 6% coupon, that's not really what it should be now. We think it should be, let's say, 5.8%. So in other words, the coupon is a little nicer than it should be. And so that means that this debt will sell at a somewhat of a premium to par. Instead of 6%, the yield to maturity should be about, say, well, it should be 5.8%. So that reflects in the price of the bond. The price of the bond might be 102.8. So then what we would have to do is, in order to calculate the market value of that debt, we would have to take the 100 million times 1.028. That's pretty much what we would, that's what we'd have to do, is just adjust it to the market. Now, we're going to do the same thing. It's not as tedious when we do it with equity. But again, the main point is that when you look at the total numbers, debt and equity, the one thing that you want to do is reflect the market's value of the debt. Take the book value and times it by the adjustment that the market has made in its current mood. The next thing, but nevertheless, we also still want to take it 1 minus the tax rate for the after-tax cost of debt. Now, on the equity side, the cost of equity, first of all, the value of the equity. Now, if I look at the book value, that means I look at the accounting. The accounting says that the total shareholders' equity is, let's say, $200 million. And there are 1 million shares outstanding. So the book value of per share, the book value per share would be 200 divided by 1 million, 200 million divided by 1 million, or $200 a share. That is not necessarily going to get you anything at all, because the book value is really not much related at all to the market value of the company. To get the market value of the equity, the total market value of the equity, all you do is look at the market cap. Go to Yahoo Finance or your favorite finance reporting platform, and it will show you the current market value of the debt. It's called the market cap, the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. That is the number that you would use for the total value of the equity. Now for the cost of equity. That one gets to be a little bit more formulaic. But just to emphasize this, the book value of the debt of this company is, let's say, $100 million. In other words, it has borrowed, it has issued bonds to raise $100 million. And that's what's written on the book. And you see that in the accounting statements. Now, let's say that the equity on the books is, let's say, $400 million. So in other words, from the book standpoint, this company has a capitalization of a total capitalization of $500 million. So debt constitutes 25% of the capital structure. And equity constitutes, debt constitutes 20% of the capital structure, and equity constitutes 80% of the capital structure of the company from the book value point of view. However, suppose that the market has said, well, right now, these bonds are selling at 105 on 100. These bonds are selling at a premium to par. You want to buy one of these bonds, it's going to cost you $1,050. So this one, the adjustment would be 1.05. So the market would be $105 million. And let's say that the market cap of this company is now, you just look for the number. You don't even need a factor, really. You just look at the number. This company has a market to book, let's say, of 5-1. So we look at this company, and this company is now a $1 billion. Like I said, you just look there at the top in Yeehaw Finance. You just look at that. As a matter of fact, let me remind you of that. Let me just. No, I didn't. Okay, share. Okay, now look here. Let me drag this down a little bit here. And get us back up. Let me pull one up here. I don't know, a company like, don't say Tesla, for heaven's sakes. Let's take, for example, something that's in reasonably healthy shape that hasn't been destroyed. For heaven's sakes, my mind is freezing up now. Can someone please give me a suggestion here?
United Airlines.
United? Oh, really? Well, that ought to be a bloodbath today. United Airline Holdings. Ooh, that ought to be bloody. Come on. Even the internet is dragging today. Who broke the internet? Okay, the market cap. See that? Now, if I went over to the SEC and looked at the book value of the equity of this company, as a matter of fact, let me do that really quickly. I'm going to jump over here on the same screen so I don't have to switch. SEC.gov. And I'm going to look at the most recent 10K and see what the book value of the equity is. Boy, is everything so dragging today. I had some of my gaming friends who were just griping company filings.
The audio is bad again.
Company filing search. And wow. I didn't check the symbol. United Airline Holding. United. Okay, looking at the most recent 10K here very quickly. Really? They got a ton of 8Ks. Good grief. Wow. Well, I can look at it quickly at a 10Q. I'd rather look at a K. But look at this mess of 8Ks. Now, remember, the 8K is one for non-recurring events. So they've had a whole lot of non-recurring events recently for some reason. Well, there we go. Way down there. Just really quick, I wanted to go through this financial statements. Let's look at the consolidated balance sheet. Consolidated balance sheet. Okay, there we go. Now, if you would look down here at the bottom and down, other shareholders' equity. So the total shareholders' equity of United Airlines is $8.768 billion. That would be the book approach. But now if I go back here far enough and go back to United Airlines and keep going back to United Airlines, and one more time, I'm going to run out of cash in the back. Okay. The company's market cap is actually less than its book value. That's not what you usually expect. You usually expect the market value to be well above the book value. So this company, United Airlines, I wouldn't put that 8.7, whatever it was, as my value. I would not use that. I would use the market 7.878 billion because that's what the markets say the company's equity is worth in total right now. We don't care about what it was at the time of origins of those book numbers. We care about the market's assessment. So here would be a case. Now, usually the market cap is going to be larger than the book value, although I shouldn't say that. I haven't been looking lately. With this crash, as heavy as this crash was, you might see more than a few companies right now where the market cap is actually lower than the book value, considering how the market has creamed a lot of stocks lately. Okay. Well, anyway, so in this case, but anyway, back to the one that I had here. The market total value of the corporation. The markets, not the books. The books here is $500 million. The market's total value of the corporation is $1.005 billion. A considerably different number from what the book would give you, what the accounting statements would give you. That's an important thing to think about here, is that if we are going to truly do these kinds of calculations, we can't talk about the accounting numbers because they are not reflecting the current reality of this company. It would be like in some ways we hold people to their past behavior. We believe that past is prologue, but in a real sense, even people are a lot different now from what they were when they were at their beginnings, at their origins. They are different now than what they were at their best and at their worst. So in a way, even when you're thinking about anything, even beyond finance, past is not prologue. We've got to look at what is now the operation. Especially here, because look at the weight of debt. The weight of debt, if you use the book, would be $100 million divided by $500 million, which would be 20%, 0.20. And the weight of equity would be $400 million divided by the $500 million. which would be 80%. So we would say, if we looked at only the accounting, we'd say debt to total assets is 20% and equity to total assets is 80%. But if we look at what the market has done, it has reshaped those numbers to reflect current reality of the corporation, not something that happened in the past. We would have to say that the weight of debt in the company's capital structure is now 105 million divided by 1,105,000,000. And the weight of equity is, come on, 1 billion divided by 1,105,000,000. Now let me get you up to this on the main screen now here. And so the weight of debt, if you use the book, is 100 million divided by the total 500 million, 20%. And the weight of equity is the 400 million divided by the 500 million, 80%. But if you use the market values, and I appreciate there's some glare on that screen. I'm still trying to figure out how to set up the lighting in here for that. Let me pull up a calculator very quickly, and I'll just give you the numbers. The weight of debt would be 105 million divided by 9.5%. The market weight of debt is just 9.5% now. And the market weight of the equity would be 90.5%. That is a heck of a lot different from what the book numbers for the weights are. That, in other words, this company appears to be, you know, it's got some debt in its capital structure. About 20% of the company is debt, 80% is equity. But the market says that's no longer the case. We have twisted the numbers. This is the reality. This company's debt is a lot lower as a percentage of its total capital structure. And its equity is considerably higher as a percentage of its capital structure. Okay, so now we see that even the weights, the weights that you do in the weighted average cost of capital, you need to look at those as market weights, not as book weights. Now let me take this off and get back to the costs themselves. Cost for the debt. For the debt, you will have the after-tax cost of debt is going to be the pre-tax cost of debt times 1 minus the tax rate. And remember, this you use, the best thing to use is the yield to maturity on its outstanding debt. Use the market's assessment of what the company would pay now if it needed to borrow new money. That's what the yield to maturity is basically telling you. The cost of equity. That one can be a pain in the backside. Couple of ways to approach it. The best way, maybe even the easiest way, is to say that the current cost of the stock, of the shareholder's position, would be R sub F, the risk-free rate, plus the beta of the stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. In other words, you would use the capital asset pricing model. You'd have to get estimates of the expected return of the market portfolio. For the risk-free rate, you'd probably just take a short-term T-bill and just crank this little formula out, and there's your Uncle Bob right there. There's your cost of equity. If you don't want to do it that way, well, the next thing you have to do is really sweat. If this information is not really, you don't trust it, or you don't want to use the cap down, the next thing we would have to do is go back to the dividend growth model for pricing a stock. You'll remember that we can find, if a company pays a dividend, the current price of the stock is the dividend one period out over R minus G. That R is the stock, the cost of the company's equity. Oh, okay. And remember, this D1 is actually the current dividend grown one period out. Now remember, this formula is only for companies that do pay a dividend. So it's kind of dodgy that way. And notice something interesting. The price of the stock goes up if the company pays better dividends. Listen carefully. You might find something about what I'm about to say on the quiz tonight. Again, the price of the stock goes up if the company pays better dividends. That's like a duh, sure. Another thing that's interesting is if the cost of the company's equity goes down, that will increase the price of the stock as well. In other words, in an environment where all interest rates are going down, that should boost stock prices. That's why the Fed was busting itself and it's been drilling interest rates down to the point where they're virtually zero, in the hope that this would boost stock prices. Didn't work too well because there are other factors at work. Another thing, notice also that if the growth rate of the company goes up, that makes the whole denominator smaller, which makes the whole fraction bigger. So when the growth rate increases, that makes the stock price increase as well. So in other words, you want the price of a stock to go up, dividend has to go up, the cost of equity to the company has to go down, or the company's growth rate has to go up. Any one of those factors will cause the stock price to go up. That kind of is a key here, by the way. Why didn't stock prices go up when the Fed was crushing all interest rates down? Well, it's because these companies were just beaten to hell. They're not going to grow. Matter of fact, they're going to have probably negative growth rates for at least 6 quarters. A negative growth rate makes this a negative here makes this plus this, which makes the whole denominator bigger, which drives the stock price down. That's why the Fed really couldn't cause the stock prices to go up by pushing interest rates down as hard as they have been for the last couple of weeks. It's not going to work because these companies have growth rates that have gone to zero or even negative, which causes the denominator to get bigger, and therefore the whole formula becomes smaller. The whole price becomes smaller. Just something to keep in mind. Make sure you have that in your notes for the quiz tonight. Might help you. Okay, now, getting out of that. What does this have to do with finding the cost of equity? Well, we said, no, we don't want to use CAPM. So what are we going to do? Okay. Let me rearrange this formula a little bit. If I do a little bit of algebra, cross-multiplying, I would find that the cost of equity itself is actually going to be D1 over the current price plus G. I put the R minus G over here, then divide by P0, and then I add the G to both sides, and that gets me the R sub S, the cost of equity. That can find you the cost of equity right there. Similarly, if it's preferred stock, this is common stock that pays a dividend. With preferred stock, since there's no growth of the dividend, it's just a flat dividend forever, it would just be the dividend, D, and there wouldn't be any plus G on it. So in other words, if you're pricing preferred, the cost of preferred stock, then it would just be the flat dividend divided by the price of the stock. And that would be the cost of preferred in the capital structure of the corporation. Before I go on, notice something, however, right here. This formula right here. Notice something that's a little bit, seems almost a counterintuitive at first, but it actually isn't counterintuitive at all. Let me get this off here and then get my screen back up here so I can tell whether you can actually see this. There's a lot of glare on the screen. I can see that right now. Okay. See this formula right here. R sub S, the cost of common stock equity, is the dividend next period divided by the current price plus the growth rate. Notice something. As the stock price goes up, this whole fraction would go down. In other words, a company has an incentive to bring its stock price up because that, by implication, makes the company's cost of equity go down. This actually had some real consequence when I was a consultant. There were several times when at a meeting, I would report, well, the company stock price is going down quite a bit. And there was this common theme. Well, why should we care? We already raised money. So we're not going to try to raise more money through stock. So it really doesn't matter to us. Well, yeah, it does in a backhanded way. Because as that price goes down, their cost of equity is going up. That is an implicit drag on the company. Doesn't seem like it is, and these people who are involved in these companies were more like, well, let's just get the day's work done, let's get this product out of prototype and get it out on the market, let's get a press release out and all that. They didn't understand that as a price was going down, they were getting sicker and sicker. The company was becoming running like a fever. It didn't see it internally, but from the outside, the company was slowing down. Its cost, one of its major costs of capital, its equity cost of capital, was dragging it. Couldn't tell. I just kind of gave up. I'd explained to them what I was talking about, but they just thought that was theoretical mumbo jumbo. But it really did have consequences. The other thing is, notice something else. The cost of your stock actually goes up if the growth rate of the company goes up. Companies that are growing rapidly tend to have higher costs of equity in their capital structure. The growth is itself like a fever. It's making the company grow fast, but that fast growth comes as a consequence of a higher cost of equity. The logic being that higher growth means that there is more risk being taken in that company. And more risk being taken in the company must translate into higher expectations of returns from investors. Your company is growing very rapidly. That is wonderful. However, a high growth company is also a risky company. And therefore, a risky company, we expect to get more out of this company if we buy your stock. So now, let me take this off and put these in a summary fashion for you. Well, that's the latest it's been all day. I'll have to wait for my guest speaker until next week. But, okay, cost of debt after tax is the pre-tax yield to maturity you use times 1 minus t. Nothing. No, that one's actually not that hard. Cost of equity. Common stock is outstanding. The R sub S is going to be D1 over P0 plus G. If you don't want to use a cap F, you can always use the cap capitalized at pricing model. R sub S equals R sub F plus beta of the stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus risk-free rate. You can do that too. If it's preferred stock, then R sub P, we would put that, is just the flat dividend that's being paid forever divided by the price. There's no growth in the dividend, so it's just you take the growth out of there. There's one more, though. You see, when a company spends money, and I'll emphasize this next week, and I'll have my guests in here for that one. When a company raises money through an investment banking syndicate, it doesn't get the price per share. Let's say the offering is going to go off at $50 a share. The company does not get $50 for every share that is sold. It gets $50 minus the commission that the investment banking syndicate takes. That means that the cost of new common stock is not that right there. It's not. It actually is this, and I would put that as R sub N, is D1 over P0 minus the float. See this F right here? That is the float. That's how much of every share of common stock. Ow, I almost hurt. Ow, that hurt. God. That's P0 workers' comp right there. Minus this flotation amount. Suppose the company takes out 10%. Okay, we are raising money for you. We sell a share of stock for $50 for you, we get 10% of that. So we get $5. So in this case, it would be $50 minus $5, $45. In other words, new common stock has a higher component cost of capital than existing common stock does. Because you are starting out not with the $50 that it says on your book. You're starting out with the $50 minus the commission that was taken. Now, sometimes this F is just a number. Sometimes it's a percentage. So if I said the brokers take out, the investment bankers take out 10%, you would just take the current price of the stock at which they're selling it at times 0.90 to get what the actual amount the company gets is. But or it could be just a dollar amount. This every share of common stock that the that is sold new, but for the company by investment bankers, they take out $7. So in that case, it would be an actual number in there. But one way or the other, there is the shape of it. So in general, the weighted average cost of capital is the weight of debt times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity times the cost of equity. But we recognize that the cost of equity, if it's got preferred stock, you got to see how much, what percentage of the total equity is preferred. If it's got new common stock that's just coming out, you got to include that. Usually we don't do that. But you have to look at the common stock, how much of that is, how much of the total equity is common stock that's on the books. How much of that company's equity is preferred stock? In general, the preferred stock, it's not going to be a significant amount. The last point that I would make here is notice that I do that thing with the over P0 minus F for new common stock, but I don't do it for preferred. The reason is something I had mentioned before. Generally, investment bankers don't charge a whole heck of a lot for issuing. The float is very small for preferred stock. Similarly, I don't make any distinction between new and existing debt because, again, the investment banks don't really hit for a big float on those. On common stock, oh yeah, that's where they make their money, is doing these IPOs and these seasoned offerings. They take out a coin, which means that every time a company goes out there to raise capital through selling stock, new stock, that is the most expensive way to raise capital. And then you would ask yourself, why are they doing this? Is that the only thing they can do is sell common stock, do an IPO, do a seasoned offering? Otherwise, if I see an IPO, I'm not going to get too excited about it. I might play it for that surge that they do at the beginning to make a lot of money for themselves and their best clients. But other than that, I worry when a company goes out with an IPO or sells a bunch of new common stock. That's the most expensive way you can raise capital. Why are you doing that way? Why don't you just use bonds, borrow? The reason is sometimes pretty simple. They've used debt so much that that's going to be a very expensive thing if they try to do it again. The bond buyers, the lenders are going to say, you are a risky company now because you've borrowed so much. So now we would charge you an arm and a leg. Your coupon would have to be really high. In a case like that, it might end up being the case that selling common stock is actually, even if it's expensive, it would be less expensive than what lenders would expect for the coupon on a new issue of debt. That's it. You got, in 5 minutes, the VeggieNet opens up a test for you, and there's an accommodation version for those of you who need that. But other than that, I have office hours tomorrow. If you want to stop by, it'll be from 12 to 1. I will send out the link to the meeting, the Zoom meeting, tomorrow morning. Other than that, that's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.